hold its own in a real amateur radio DX corn test. We're all ears. This is Ralph Squillaci, KK6ITB.
With thanks to Alabama Contest Group, the ARRL, Arts Technica, CQ Magazine, CNN, David BR, K7DB, DXWorld.net, Indian YL Echo LinkNet, Levi C. Maya, K6LCM, Ohio Penn DX, QRZ.com, Southgate Amateur Radio News, ShortwaveRadio.de, YouTube, and you, our listeners. That's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline. We remind listeners.
This is Janet McKean from Caro, and you're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM, hands-on radio.
On the next Deep Threes, Norwegian guitarist Geir Stunstall dives into his instrument collection to produce an album of underwater music, and we'll hear the results. Plus tracks from Africane 808, Floating Points, Edgar Meyer, and Umanzuki. Deep Threes, music beyond boundaries for a digital world.
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
New WGXC programmer Matthew O'Neill has a record release show at the Avalon Lounge in Catskill on September 3rd at 8 p.m. His new album is called Connection. On the bill of the record release show is Morgan O'Kane opening and Otto Hauser playing DJ during the show. Again, that's Saturday, September 3rd at 8 to 11 p.m. at the Avalon Lounge in Catskill. And there'll also be a live WGXC.org web stream and a broadcast on 90.7 FM. So turn out or tune in for the Matthew O'Neill record release show, Saturday, September 3rd at the Avalon Lounge in Catskill.
WGXC underwriting support has been provided by Dedicated Presentation Solutions. Allow DPS to turn your audiovisual how-do-I's into here's-how-you-cans. Visit dedicatedpresentation.com or call 845-475-8465 for more information. Dedicated Presentation Solutions, your audiovisual partner.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of the Bridge Street Theater in Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
90.7 FM.
Acra, Hudson, Catskill.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acra with the WGXC News Update. Go to the WGXC Newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Diane Valden reports for the Columbia paper that in light of recent accidents, residents along Columbia County Route 7A have renewed their appeal for a lower speed limit on the stretch of road between the Copaic Hamlet and Ankrum Town Line. At the August 13th Copaic Town Board meeting, several residents talked about their experiences living along the road with many curves, blind spots, and an onslaught of lead-footed drivers. Gabrielle Tesler told the board she opposes the 55-mile-per-hour speed limit between the Copaic and West Copaic in a densely populated area where people bike, jog, walk, and children and animals cross the road. She was hit by a car on that stretch of road while riding her bike a year ago, she said. Tesler suggested that because of a recent traffic death, the State Department of Transportation, which has the power to resolve the issue, would agree to lower the speed limit. The death Tesler referred to occurred on July 31st when a car and a motorcycle collided on Route 7A at the Tamarack Road intersection. Lisa Edstrom, Tesler's neighbor, wanted to know what residents could do to, quote, pressure the state, unquote, to reduce the speed limit. Stephen Sanborn noted that the town had taken action to curb speeders in the past by posting an electronic speed limit sign and increasing the police presence. He said that helped somewhat, but the whole stretch of road still remains a problem. Supervisor Janie Mettler said last year town officials submitted a request to lower the speed limit from 55 to 40 miles per hour between the Copaic Hamlet and West Copaic. In November, the town request was denied, with the state DOT saying the circumstances did not warrant a reduction. Mettler suggested this time she write a resolution containing a specific speed reduction and include the facts instead of just submitting a standard request. The formal speed limit resolution will be presented to the town board on September 8th. Read more about this story in the Columbia paper. Kenneth C. Crow II is reporting for the Times Union that the St. Regis Mohawk Tribe and the U.S. Department of Commerce Economic Development Administration have announced the tribe will receive a $857,000 federal grant to promote tourism in northern New York through job and tourism business expansion under the Oxwani Travel Program. The two-year grant is funded by the American Rescue Plan's Indigenous Communities Program. The St. Regis Mohawk Indian Territory is located in the Hogansburg area in Franklin County. Quote, our region is rich in culture and history, and this grant will allow us to continue sharing these vibrant community resources by investing in local business development and building our capacity, unquote, said James Lazor, the tribe's division director in the Office of Economic Development. The project will fund three new full-time positions under tourism to develop new cultural experiences, provide more business support to tour partners, and to engage with regional partners and the travel trade industry. St. Regis Mohawk Tribe Executive Director Tarasio Barrio said the award was the result of the tourism team's efforts to support the Aquanese business community, local artisans, and cultural resource organizations such as the Aquanese Cultural Center and the Museum and the Native North American Traveling College. Read more about this story in the Times Union. And read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day 7,000 white and Filipino lettuce workers in California's Salinas Valley walked out on strike. Salinas was the lettuce capital of the world. The division of labor in the valley was largely ethnically based. Filipinos did much of the field labor while whites worked in the packing sheds. At the time, Filipinos made up 40% of the total agricultural workforce in the Salinas Valley. They had founded the Filipino Labor Union a year earlier. White packing shed workers had organized into the AFL's Vegetable Packers Association. While the VPA had been reluctant to work with the FLU, they now sought to join forces in strike action. Both unions agreed neither would return to work until both had achieved victory. Together, they demanded wage increases, union recognition, and better working conditions. Losing $100,000 a day, the growers soon imported scabs of all races. They enlisted the California Highway Patrol to arrest striking Filipinos on incitement and vagrancy charges. Soon, the VPA agreed to arbitration, leaving the FLU to continue the strike alone. Some speculated the members were threatened with the loss of their charter if they refused to return to work. The striking Filipino workers continued to organize job actions and experienced increased retaliation as a result. VPA leaders publicly distanced themselves from the Filipino strikers and racially charged vigilante violence intensified. It culminated in the burning down of the labor camp where hundreds of Filipino workers lived a month after the strike began. Vigilantes then drove as many as 800 Filipinos from the valley at gunpoint. The strike was officially called off, and those that remained returned to work. By October, both unions had won wage increases.
Howard Zinn at 100, the enduring legacy of the people's historian. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. August 24th marks 6 months since Russia launched its war on Ukraine, with millions displaced and tens of thousands of civilians and soldiers killed. That same day, August 24th, marked the centennial of the late historian Howard Zinn's birth. Zinn was an author, a professor, an anti-war activist. His seminal book, A People's History of the United States, revealed a different dissident perspective on the historical arc of the Western Hemisphere, from Christopher Columbus's arrival in 1492 to the so-called War on Terror. First published in 1980, A People's History has become a standard text with over 2 million copies in print. Howard Zinn died in 2010 at the age of 87. His words, more than a decade after his death, are still worth hearing in a world racked by war, racism, and inequality.
War poisons everybody who engages in it.
That's Howard Zinn in a 2006 address in Madison, Wisconsin. The United States was waging two major wars at the time in Iraq and Afghanistan and supporting ongoing conflicts elsewhere. Howard Zinn continued,
"We've had a history of war after war after war after war. What have they solved? What have they done?"
Howard Zinn volunteered to serve in World War II, becoming a bombardier. He participated in the bombing of Royan, a small town along the coast of France, in April 1945.
It was a few weeks before the war was going to be over, and everybody knew it was going to be over.
That's Howard Zinn speaking on Democracy Now! NewsHour in 2005.
But there was a little pocket of German soldiers hanging around this little town of Royan on the Atlantic coast of France, and the Air Force decided to bomb them. 1,200 heavy bombers, and I was in one of them, flew over this little town of Royan and dropped napalm, first use of napalm in the European theater. And we don't know how many people we killed or how many people were terribly burned as a result of what we did, but I did it like most soldiers do, unthinkingly, mechanically, thinking we're on the right side, they're on the wrong side, and therefore we can do whatever we want and it's okay.
Howard Zinn visited the French seaside resort in 1966 to speak with survivors. He wrote a detailed history of the raid and its consequences. He said on Democracy Now!,
"It was a great sobering lesson about so-called good wars."
In Zinn's 2006 Wisconsin speech, he talked about the casualties of war.
The different ratio of civilian to military deaths in war, how in World War I, 10 military dead for one civilian dead. In World War II, it was 50-50, half military, half civilian. In Vietnam, it was 70% civilian and 30% military. And in the wars since then, it's 80% and 85% civilian.
Howard Zinn taught at Spelman, a historically black women's college in Atlanta, during the height of the civil rights movement. Among his students were a young Alice Walker and Children's Defense Fund founder Marion Wright Edelman. Professor Zinn explained on Democracy Now!,
"Well, at Spelman, I got involved with my students in the actions that were going on in the South, the sit-ins, the demonstrations, the picket lines."
His solidarity got him fired. In 2005, Professor Zinn was invited back to Spelman to deliver the commencement address. Howard Zinn was a prominent opponent of the war in Vietnam. In 1968, he and activist priest Father Dan Berrigan flew to North Vietnam, coordinating the first release of U.S. prisoners of war held there. When renowned whistleblower Dan Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers, the U.S. government's secret history of its involvement in Vietnam, Howard Zinn and his late wife Roz hid a copy of the documents in their home. His dedication to peace and anti-war activism continued unabated throughout his life. August 24th, in addition to the anniversary of Zinn's birth, is also the day that Ukraine marks its independence from the Soviet Union. This year, independence celebrations were banned across Ukraine for fear of Russian attacks. Russia did strike a rail station on that day in eastern Ukraine, killing at least 25 people, including children. On the same day, President Joe Biden announced an additional $3 billion in military aid to Ukraine, bringing the total in U.S. military aid to Ukraine since Biden took office to $13.5 billion. Howard Zinn is not here to condemn this war or any of the others now being fought. But through his example, his activism, and the enduring relevance of his writings, we can commit on the centennial of his birth to reiterate one of his central messages: war is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Here is this week's environmental news from WGXC. Go to the WGXC newsroom, wgxc.org, for more about these stories and others. And Roger Hannigan Gilson is reporting for the Times Union that a green slick of toxic bacteria has formed on a large section of the Wallkill River in Ulster County. over the past several days. Commonly referred to as algae blooms, these slicks actually consist of a toxic form of cyanobacteria, which can be harmful to humans and deadly to dogs. The Department of Environmental Conservation received 9 reports of the toxic bloom during the past week on a section of the Wallkill from the village of New Paltz to Sturgeon Pool in Rifton. There's been an additional report of cyanobacteria in the Wallkill tributary Roundout Creek in Rosendale, suggesting the slick might be spreading to the city of Kingston. But according to Dan Shapley, the co-director of science and patrol for the environmental group Riverkeeper, the size of the slick is far greater. Shapley said the slick extends more than 14 miles from the community gardens in New Paltz to Creek Locks in Rosendale, where the Wallkill meets the Roundout. Cyanobacteria can release toxins that can cause irritation and a burning sensation when touching human skin. Ingesting or breathing in droplets of water with these toxins can lead to illness, and some people experience allergic reactions and breathing difficulties when exposed, according to the Department of Environmental Conservation. The slicks can be much more harmful to dogs, resulting in stumbling, difficulty breathing, elevated heart rate, seizures, convulsions, and paralysis. Dogs occasionally die from exposure, according to Shapley. Cyanobacteria develops in water bodies when 2 distinct conditions exist: high levels of nitrogen and phosphorus, both of which are found in fertilizer and warm, still water. This is not the first time the slicks have struck the Wallkill. Blooms have been reported near New Paltz dating back to 2015, according to the DEC. A bloom in 2016 affected 30 miles of the river from Montgomery to Orange County to Rosendale and lasted for more than 50 days. Read more about this story in the Times Union.
Lauren Harkowick is reporting in the Times Union. The Cary Institute, a local nonprofit environmental organization, has asked Congress for a hearing on why the government's current practices for limiting invasive pests are not working. Invasive pests like the emerald ash borer and Asian longhorned beetle pose irreversible threats to the state's forest ecosystems by targeting native trees and, in some cases, threatening to wipe them out for good. According to the Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies, based in Millbrook, Dutchess County, the pests that primarily enter the country through packaging used in international trade is, and I quote, one of the most severe and urgent threats facing U.S. trees, end quote. In July, the Institute delivered a petition with more than 1,700 signatures to the U.S. House and Senate Agriculture Committees requesting a congressional hearing on invasive forest pests. Cary's Dr. Gary Lovett said last week that he wants Congress to investigate what is currently being done and why government agencies' current practices for keeping invasive pests out are not working. Asked why he thinks current practices are not working, Lovett said the government is not being firm enough in its regulatory standards for international trade. International trade is how most invasive pests get into the country, often through wooden packaging, such as wood pallets. Pests like emerald ash borer and hemlock woolly adelgid could dramatically change the forest landscape of the Northeast, and New York is the hardest hit in the country. Emerging major concerns, Lovett said, are the spotted lanternfly, which attacks grapes and apples, and the Asian longhorn beetle, which attacks maples. Read the full story in the Times Union. Clarence Fanto in the Berkshire Eagle reports on how the current drought will affect the fall foliage. The experts asked say the colorful leaves this year could be delayed and less vibrant. In Pittsfield, Massachusetts, for instance, only 0.80 inches of rain have fallen so far this month, far short of the 3-inch long-term average for the first 24 days of August. The U.S. Drought Monitor has much of the Hudson Valley in a moderate or severe drought. AccuWeather meteorologist Tom Kind said, and I quote, "It's not going to be a great fall for observing leaf colors. You need beneficial rain. You don't want it really hot, but we've struck out on those," end quote. Fall foliage expert Jim Salge at Yankee Magazine was more optimistic. Salge said, and I quote, "With the warmer weather and the drought, we're expecting a shorter than usual season. That's a guarantee, and plenty of red colors more likely than not. Reds are beautiful. Some of our best foliage years have been abnormally dry years," end quote.
But if the drought continues, leaves are likely to turn brown prematurely and dry out. Karen Lombard, Director of Stewardship and Restoration for Massachusetts at the Nature Conservancy, said, and I quote, "Species such as maples that provide the most brilliant displays are more sensitive to drought than other species," end quote. And you can read the full story in the Berkshire Eagle. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you are there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Are joined by our friend Henry the Hudson Whale for some Hudson River stories from the past week. How have you been doing, Henry? All right, well, the U.S. Geological Survey reports temperatures this week in the Hudson River near Albany are between 78 and 80 degrees. ABC News reports that the City Club of New York and Tom Fox, a representative of the club who serves on the Hudson River Park Advisory Council, plan to sue Con Edison for alleged, quote, ongoing violations, unquote, of the Federal Clean Water Act. They allege that Con Ed is dumping water used to cool a power station off of Hudson River Park's Pier 98 in New York City into the river at, quote, dangerously high temperatures, unquote, and are also dumping wastewater containing, quote, toxic pollutants, unquote, such as chloroform, into the estuary sanctuary in violation of its state permit. Con Ed spokesperson said the company is, quote, in compliance with our permit for both water temperature and discharge of chemicals at Pier 98, unquote. Read more about this story at the ABC News website. Post-Star reports that the lower levels of the Hudson River west of the Glens Falls-South Glen Falls Route 9 bridge have exposed riverbanks, drainage pipes, the underside of a swimming dock, and old mid-river piers once used when logs were moved downstream by force of the current. The low levels of the river are not from the drought, but a summer drawdown to allow for routine dam maintenance. Because of the up to 8-foot reduction in water levels, there is no summer swimming at municipal beaches in Glens Falls and South Glens Falls, and regular water levels won't return until September. Read more about this story in the Post Star. Paul Kirby reports in the Daily Freeman that a 2-foot-long sea lamprey was fished out of the Hudson River by the Department of Environmental Conservation in June. Lamprey are strange-looking jawless fish that, quote, feed parasitically on larger fish using their round mouth ringed with hooked teeth, unquote, the department said on social media. They are rarely found at the agency's Norrie Point Environmental Center in Stottsburg in Dutchess County, where DEC estuary educator Ben Harris caught one with a cast net. Quote, sea lamprey occurs as amosiates in medium-sized streams near the mouths and in areas with clean sand, unquote, the DEC said. Quote, the adult phase is parasitic and typically found only in the big lakes or the ocean, unquote. Sea lampreys attack fish in the Hudson River, not humans. The National Ocean Service calls the lamprey, quote, an efficient killer of lake trout and other bony fishes as its disc-shaped suction cup mouth ringed with sharp, horny teeth, which it latches onto an unfortunate fish, unquote. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. And those are this week's Hudson River stories with our friend Henry the Hudson Whale. See you next week, Henry. Yeah. I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Renewable Weather Forecast. We start each renewable weather forecast with the current price of fossil fuels in Greene County, the lowest price according to the Gas Buddy website for a gallon of gas. It's $4.03 at the Citgo in South Cairo. And the air quality forecast we look at is a 20 forecast for Sunday. That's about the same as Saturday. And then the National Weather Service in Albany says Sunday should be partly sunny with a high of 81 and a wind from the south 5 to 8 miles per hour spinning local windmills. Sunday night, again, it'll be partly cloudy with a low around 63 and a south wind around 7 miles per hour. Monday should be mostly sunny, good for the local solar panels with a high of 86, south wind 3 to 7 miles per hour and a low around 68. And on Tuesday, there is a 60% chance of showers, possibly a thunderstorm after 2 p.m. Otherwise, it'll be sunny with a high of 87 and a low around 63. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson. Solar-powered radio for open ears. Monday, August 29th, tune in to all sorts of creative community voices on the radio at 90.7 FM. Including at 9 a.m., we've got environmental news from around the Hudson Valley on the WGXC Morning Show. Then hop on the Afrosonic Taxi at 10 a.m. with music from Elaine Correa, Monica Nieves, and Diane Carrera Fernandez, among others. At 11 a.m., Brendan Donegan is playing favorites with his Bob Dylan collection, live from the WGXC Hudson studio in the basement of the First Presbyterian Church on Warren Street. At 2 p.m., it's time for the Vital Weekly Show with brand new music from around the world, including tracks this week from Greg Davis, Amelia Cooney, and Jeff Arnell. At 3 p.m., Liz LaJudas has her echolocation show on, and she's listening to Hudson River sounds this week. At 7 p.m., it's time for the Law and Disorder program, and then at 8, we go to Bontanuts Radio with music this week from Burner Boy, Bonobo, and Dizzy Gillespie on the radio at 90.7 FM, WGXC.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to the January 6th hearings, which will finally determine the criminal culpability of former fake president Donald Jessica Trump. Now let's go to some behind-the-scenes DVD extras from his pre-recorded address to the nation on January 7th. Okay, whenever you're ready, sweetie.
And we are rolling. Everyone, please clear the set. We're rolling. Thank you. Okay, Mr. President, you're on in 5.
You got this, bitch.
3, 2.
I would like to begin by addressing the heinous attack yesterday.
Sing out, Louise.
But this election is now over. Congress has certified the results. I don't want to say the election's over. I just want to say...
Just say you're a big fat loser.
My only goal was to ensure the integrity of the vote.
Let's take that again.
I would like to begin by addressing the heinous attack yesterday. Yesterday is a hard word for me.
Yesterday. Such a complicated word to say. When his dentures start to slip away, he's not okay with yesterday. Plain to see how he screwed with our democracy. Binging Big Macs while he watched TV. This just ain't on our history. When the votes came through, they were blue instead of red. So he said, if you staged a coup and went to bed, this guy, and the hypocrites who still comply.
Joined now by the man everyone's talking about, Attorney General Garland. Judy, seditious conspiracy, espionage, bad hair. What the hell is it going to take to nail this guy? No pressure.
The Justice Department has been doing the most wide-ranging